Thursday, January 27th, Bess and I left the snowy Washington by an early plane for New York. We thought we'd have to catch a train. But a lull in the storm and a quick decision put us on the shuttle, and we were at the Carlisle by 10:45. I spent all day in that world of fashion, the morning with Molly Parnes, afternoon with Mr. St. Moore, and I hope I'll get enough clothes in these years never to have to go back again. But while I'm here, I want to look as well as I can for Lyndon and for this role. When it was over, I found myself quite tired. So I treated myself to a facial and lying in bed reading an F. Scott Fitzgerald book of short stories while I looked out the window at the incomparable view of New York as twilight deepened. The memory of the Princess and the Fairy Tower is a little more remote now. And then the big event of the day. Tonight, Brooke Astor, Mrs. Vincent Astor, and Jane and Charles Engelhard gave a dinner party for me. It was in Brooke's exquisite apartment, filled with paintings. I think I recognized a Matisse, a Picasso, a Fragonard, the most beautifully arranged flowers, pale apricot tulips, and pear and cherry blossoms that belied the snow outside. I wore my green St. Maur evening dress that I'd bought for the Princess Margaret dinner, because I considered it my smartest. And then, as I stepped off the elevator, a cavern yawned before me. There stood Jane Engelhard, always magnificently dressed, this time in black, exactly like mine. She had on such magnificent diamond earrings, a necklace to match, which she casually described as a piece of the chandelier fell off. Actually, she'd had them made when she was chairman of the Diamond Ball, a charity benefit that she had initiated and sponsored for years, and how fitting that it should be named the Diamond Ball because of her husband's business. Brooke Astor wore a white lace dress that was at once the essence of innocence and also provocative. She's a gay, vital person who embraces life and works with and enjoys those things her foundation helps. For me, she's one of the happy additions to those I came to know in 1965. There were enough old friends there to make me feel cozy and at home. The Lawrence Rockefellers, Phyllis Dillon, people I'd met but wanted to know better. The John Loebs, who gave the lovely yellow room at the White House, and the Henry Parishes, she's Sister Parish, who decorated the room for Mrs. Kennedy, and the Arthur Houghtons, he's the president of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I'd sat beside him at the opening of 300 Years of American Art exhibit last summer, the James Hesters, who'd just been at the White House the night before. In fact, the art world was well represented. There were the Edward Warburgs, he's one of the founders of the Museum of Modern Art, the Ogden Whites, he's a member of American Museum of Natural History, Ted Russo of the Metropolitan, the Osborne Elliotts, he's the head of Newsweek, was there, Clayton Fritchie, the perennial bachelor, and the T. Reed Vreelands, he's the editor of Vogue. We were some 36 in the setting of the utmost charm, and when we went into dinner, I found myself between Charles Engelhard and Dr. Hester, suave, attractive. The president of New York University was some 43,000 students. But it was Charles Engelhard who told me the most delicious story of the evening. He was describing the courtship of his stepdaughter, a beautiful girl, Jane's child by a former marriage, with a young Mr. Reed, whose family had not found it necessary to work for three generations, so well settled was their income. Charles felt that a young man who was going to marry his daughter ought to have something else to do besides play tennis and ride and go to balls, and so he had suggested that he go to work with Engelhard Industries. That bridge was crossed all right, he would. And then the time came for the two families to meet in the polite exploration of each other's backgrounds. Charles decided to say to Mrs. Reed, "You know, I think I should tell you that Jane and I are Democrats, ardent Democrats." Mrs. Reed replied, "How interesting. We know another one, Averill Harriman." This story strengthened my belief that I was really walking in another world, a gay, beautifully appointed, charming world in which I was a complete stranger, but having a marvelous time. There were toasts, charming and witty and sweet, by Brooke, Charles, and Jane, and a reply by me that I wanted very much to be adequate. some dear words by Lawrence Rockefeller, and then we danced. I think the guest list must have been partly made up with an eye to dancers. And I also think Jane must have been sending them down the chute, like Dale on branding day at the ranch, to dance with me, because they showed up every 2 or 3 minutes. And it was delightful, wonderful change of partners, and practically all good. The few moments out, sit in the library for another drink, an especially delightful one with John Loeb, one of the most attractive men I've met. And then, presently, I discovered that the night before had been the big night of the year for many of the guests, a big charity ball, everybody up till 2 and 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning. And so it was easy to feel that it was the best thing to say goodnight about 12:30. It had been a wonderful evening, and somehow I was not a bit paralyzed by the fact that Jane and I had on the same dress. If I had been a bit more daring, I would have raised my glass to a woman whose taste in clothes I have always admired. One of the most interesting moments of the day had been a telephone conversation with Frank Stanton. I'd asked him about the library and about how we could go about finding a head of the School of Public Service. He'd used an interesting phrase. The University of California, because of their great financial resources, done more warehousing of talent. In other words, hire 'em, keep 'em, and not put 'em to work. And that possibly Clark Kerr there would be able to give us some good possibilities. Or Paul Buck, who's the head of the library at Harvard, had been provost under Conant. A George Harrar, the head of the Rockefeller Foundation. A Meredith Wilson, the president of the University of Minnesota. Dr. Jim Perkins at Cornell in Ithaca. All of these sources who would know where the bright young men on their way up were today, not themselves possibilities, but having the key to where the people were. He's a rare man, Frank Stanton, with varied knowledge in so many fields, and I regret that he has not expanded into another field, government.